Chapter 22. A handsome man. Had his brain unfolded under sharper contours, they would have said, a thoughtful man. But an inner strenuousness was preying upon an outer symmetry, and they rated his look as singular. Hence people who began, by beholding him ended by perusing him. His countenance was overlaid with legible meanings. Without being thought-worn, he yet had certain marks derived from a perception of his surroundings, such as are not unfrequently found on men at the end of the 4 or 5 years of endeavor which follow the close of placid pupillage. He already showed that thought is a disease of flesh, and indirectly bore evidence that ideal physical beauty is incompatible with emotional development and a full recognition of the coil of things. Mental luminousness must be fed with the oil of life, even though there is already a physical need for it, and the pitiful sight of two demands on one supply was just showing itself here. When standing before certain men, the philosopher regrets that thinkers are but perishable tissue, the artist that perishable tissue has to think. Thus to deplore, each from his point of view, the mutually destructive interdependence of spirit and flesh would have been instinctive with these uncritically observing Eobrite. As for his look, it was a natural cheerfulness striving against depression from without, and not quite succeeding. The look suggested isolation, but it revealed something more. As is usual with bright natures, the deity that lies ignominiously chained within an ephemeral human carcass shone out of him like a ray. The effect upon Eustacia was palpable. The extraordinary pitch of excitement that as he had reached beforehand would, indeed, have caused her to be influenced by the most commonplace man. She was troubled at Eobrite's presence. The remainder of the play ended the Saracen's head was cut off, and St. George stood as victor. Nobody commented, any more than they would have commented on the fact of mushrooms coming in autumn or snowdrops in spring. They took the piece as phlegmatically as did the actors themselves. It was a phase of cheerfulness which was, as a matter of course, to be passed through every Christmas, and there was no more to be said. They sang the plaintive chant which follows the play, during which all the dead men rise to their feet in a silent and awful manner, like the ghosts of Napoleon's soldiers in the Midnight Review. Afterwards the door opened, and Fairway appeared on the threshold, accompanied by Christian and another. They had been waiting outside for the conclusion of the play, as the players had waited for the conclusion of the dance. Come in, said Mrs. Eobright. And Clem went forward to welcome them. How is it you are so late? Grandfather Cantle has been here ever so long, and we thought you'd have come with him, as you live so near one another. Well, I should have come earlier, Mr. Fairway said and paused to look along the beam of the ceiling for a nail to hang his hat on, but, finding his accustomed one, to be occupied by the mistletoe, and all the nails in the walls, to be burdened with bunches of holly, he at last relieved himself of the hat by ticklishly balancing it between the candle box and the head of the clock case. I should have come earlier, ma'am, he resumed, with a more composed air, but I know what parties be, and how there's none too much room in folks' houses at such times, so I thought I wouldn't come till you'd got settled a bit. And I thought so too, Mrs. Eobright, said Christian earnestly, but father there was so eager that he had no manners at all, and left home almost afore 'twas dark. I told him 'twas barely decent in a old man to come so over soon, but words be wind. KLK. I wasn't going to bide waiting about till half the game was over. I'm as light as a kite when anything's going on. Crowed Grandfather Cantle from the chimney seat. Fairway had meanwhile concluded a critical gaze at Eobright. Now, you may not believe it, he said to the rest of the room, but I should never have known this gentleman if I had met him anywhere off his own head. He's altered so much. You two have altered, and for the better, I think, Timothy, said Eobright, surveying the firm figure of Fairway. Master Eobright, look me over too. I have altered for the better, haven't I, eh? said Grandfer Candle, rising, and placing himself something above half a foot from Klim's eye, to induce the most searching criticism. To be sure we will, said Fairway, taking the candle and moving it over the surface of the Grandfer's countenance, the subject of his scrutiny irradiating himself with light and pleasant smiles, and giving himself jerks of juvenility. You haven't changed much, said Eobright. If there's any difference, Grandfer is younger, appended Fairway decisively. And yet not my own doing, and I feel no pride in it, said the pleased ancient. But I can't be cured of my vagaries, though I plead guilty to. Yes, Master Candle always was that, as we know. But I am nothing by the side of you, Mr. Klim. Nor any of us, said Humphrey, in a low rich tone of admiration, not intended to reach anybody's ears. Really, there would have been nobody here who could have stood as decent second to him, or even third, if I hadn't been a soldier in the bang-up locals as we was called for our smartness, said Grandfer Candle. And even as 'tis we all look a little scamish beside him. But in the year 4 'twas said there wasn't a finer figure in the whole South Wessex than I, as I looked when dashing past the shop winders with the rest of our company on the day we ran out o' Budmouth, because it was thoughted that Tony had landed round the point. There was I, straight as a young poplar, why my firelock, and my bagnet, and my spatterdashes, and my stock sawing my jaws off, and my accoutrements sheening like the seven stars. Yes, neighbors, I was a pretty sight in my soldiering days. You ought to have seen me in 4. 'Tis his mother's side, where Master Klim's figure comes from, bless ye, said Timothy. Know it her brothers well. Longer coffins were never made in the whole country of South Wessex, and 'tis said that poor George's knees were crumpled up a little then as 'twas. Coffins, where? Inquired Christian, drawing nearer. Have the ghost of one appeared to anybody, Master Fairway? No, no. Don't let your mind so mislead your ears, Christian, and be a man, said Timothy reproachfully. I will, said Christian. But now I think out my shatter last night seemed just the shape of a coffin. What is it a sign of when your shade's like a coffin, neighbors? It can't be nothing to be afeard of, I suppose? Afeard, no, said the Grandfer. Eighth, I was never afeard of nothing except Tony, or I shouldn't have been the soldier I was. Yes, 'tis a thousand pities you didn't see me in 4. By this time the mummers were preparing to leave, but Mrs. Eobright stopped them by asking them to sit down and have a little supper. To this invitation Father Christmas, in the name of them all, readily agreed. Eustacia was happy in the opportunity of staying a little longer. The cold and frosty night without was doubly frigid to her. But the lingering was not without its difficulties. Mrs. Eobright, for want of room in the larger apartment, placed a bench for the mummers halfway through the pantry door, which opened from the sitting room. Here they seated themselves in a row, the door being left open, thus they were still virtually in the same apartment. Mrs. Eobright now murmured a few words to her son, who crossed the room to the pantry door, striking his head against the mistletoe as he passed, and brought the mummers beef and bread, cake pastry, mead, and elder wine, the waiting being done by him and his mother, that the little maid servant might sit as guest. The mummers doffed their helmets, and began to eat and drink. But you will surely have some? Said Klim to the Turkish knight, as he stood before that warrior, tray in hand. As he had refused, and still sat covered, only the sparkle of her eyes being visible between the ribbons which covered her face. None, thank you, replied Eustacia. He's quite a youngster, said the Saracen apologetically, and you must excuse him. He's not one of the old set, but of joined us, because Tother couldn't come. But he will take something, persisted Eobright. Try a glass of mead or elder wine. Yes, you had better try that, said the Saracen. It will keep the cold out going home along. Though Eustacia could not eat without uncovering her face, she could drink easily enough beneath her disguise. The elder wine was accordingly accepted, and the glass vanished inside the ribbons. At moments during this performance, Eustacia was half in doubt about the security of her position, yet it had a fearful joy. A series of attentions paid to her, and yet not to her, but to some imaginary person, by the first man as he had ever been inclined to adore, complicated her emotions indescribably. As he had loved him, partly because he was exceptional in this scene, partly because as he had determined to love him, chiefly because she was in desperate need of loving somebody, after wearying of Wildev, believing that she must love him in spite of herself, as he had been influenced after the fashion of the second Lord Lyttelton and other persons, who have dreamed that they were to die on a certain day, and by stress of a morbid imagination have actually brought about that event. Once let a maiden admit the possibility of her being stricken with love for someone at a certain hour and place, and the thing is as good as done. Did anything at this moment suggest to Eobright the sex of the creature whom that fantastic guise enclosed? How extended was her scope both in feeling and in making others feel, and how far her compass transcended that of her companions in the band? When the disguised Queen of Love appeared before Enya's, a preternatural perfume accompanied her presence, and betrayed her quality. If such a mysterious emanation ever was projected by the emotions of an earthly woman upon their object, it must have signified Eustacia's presence to Eobright now. He looked at her wistfully, then seemed to fall into a reverie, as if he were forgetting what he observed. The momentary situation ended, he passed on, and Eustacia sipped her wine without knowing what she drank. The man for whom as he had predetermined to nourish a passion went into the small room, and across it to the further extremity. The mummers, as has been stated, were seated on a bench, one end of which extended into the small apartment, or pantry, for want of space in the outer room. Eustacia, partly from shyness, had chosen the midmost seat, which thus commanded a view of the interior of the pantry as well as the room containing the guests. When Klim passed down the pantry, her eyes followed him in the gloom which prevailed there. At the remote end was a door which, just as he was about to open it for himself, was opened by somebody within, and light streamed forth. The person was Thomason, with a candle, looking anxious, pale, and interesting. Eobright appeared glad to see her, and pressed her hand. "That's right, Tamsi," he said heartily, as though recalled to himself by the sight of her, "you have decided to come down. I am glad of it." "Hush, no, no," she said quickly. "Only came to speak to you. But why not join us?" "I cannot. At least I would rather not. I am not well enough, and we shall have plenty of time together now you are going to be home a good long holiday. It isn't nearly so pleasant without you. Are you really ill?" "Just a little, my old cousin here," she said, playfully sweeping her hand across her heart. "Ah, mother should have asked somebody else to be present tonight, perhaps?" "Oh no, indeed. I merely stepped down, Klim, to ask you here." He followed her through the doorway into the private room beyond, and, the door closing, Eustacia and the mummer who sat next to her, the only other witness of the performance, saw and heard no more. The heat flew to Eustacia's head and cheeks. She instantly guessed that Klim, having been home only these 2 or 3 days, had not as yet been made acquainted with Thomason's painful situation with regard to Wildev, and seeing her living there just as he had been living, before he left home, he naturally suspected nothing. Eustacia felt a wild jealousy of Thomason on the instant. Though Thomason might possibly have tender sentiments towards another man as yet, how long could they be expected to last when she was shut up here with this interesting and traveled cousin of hers? There was no knowing what affection might not soon break out between the two, so constantly in each other's society, and not a distracting object near. Klim's boyish love for her might have languished, but it might easily be revived again. Eustacia was nettled by her own contrivances. What a sheer waste of herself to be dressed thus, while another was shining to advantage. Had she known the full effect of the encounter, she would have moved heaven and earth to get here in a natural manner. The power of her face all lost, the charm of her emotions all disguised, the fascinations of her coquetry denied existence, nothing but a voice left to her. As he had a sense of the doom of Echo. "Nobody here respects me," she said. As he had overlooked the fact that, in coming as a boy among Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.